All right. So again, this is the class on emptiness. I see maybe some new faces. You may have been here before, but this is an advanced class on the Discovering Buddhism. It's the 12th module, but we're going to do a summary so it will catch you up on what we are doing. So that should be helpful. But anyways, I know some people had a Monday work day. Some people were home. And so you are here on your own. You came here to learn. So let's do a little calm abiding meditation, and that will lead straight into motivation, okay, for today. And as you know, motivation is very important, and dedication. And you may have learned in previous classes that until you have a motivation, you don't take action. If I want to go through that door, I need to motivate myself to stand up first and take action to go to the door. But if I don't think about it, I don't go. Same thing when you're learning something, you want to develop some motivation that you really want to learn this and you really want to listen to it. And so what happens is it creates the space for you to then accept the teachings in an easier way. All right? So first, you know the basic posture of calm abiding meditation. For those sitting down, you can, of course, cross your legs, called Vajra position or lotus position. And those sitting in the chair, you want to keep your feet flat on the floor or on the pillow. Perfectly fine. You want to keep your back straight. It doesn't have to be rigid. All of these positions, just a quick note on meditation, were not for any particular reason, or you have to sit this way unless you can't meditate or nothing like that. You can meditate anywhere. However, certain positions allow people to meditate more easily, because when you're sitting straight and not rigid, you don't get tired. You don't want to slouch and fall asleep. So they tell you to just sit nice and comfortable and straight, right? They tell you to put your legs a certain way only because it keeps your spine straight, right? Because it's just the position of the body. Then they tell you to get your arms, and you want to put your arms nice and easy, allowing the air to go through here. So it's not like this, you know, and it's not like that. You just want to comfortably sit here so you don't get uncomfortable. Okay, that's the whole idea behind it. And it allows a little bit of breathing. And then your left hand is here, your right hand is on top, and your two thumbs are touching each other. Right? It allows the energy to flow throughout the body. And then your head is slightly tilted. You don't want to do this, and you don't want to be arrogant and go like this. You just want to be quiet inside here. Your eyes are not completely shut, and they're not completely open. They're shut, slightly open, but in the beginning, if you feel comfortable closing them, that's perfectly fine. As far as, you know, we're not going to do a long one here, so you're not going to fall asleep. And that's the reason. You want to keep awareness around you, but your mind is concentrating on something else, or peacefulness, right? Calmness. So that's why they say, you see even Buddha's eyes, they're slightly open, right? He's not completely shut eyes. And so we just learn from that. Your jaw and mouth is relaxed, right? Your tongue, the top of the tongue is touching the top part of the palate behind the front teeth. Just relax over there. And the reason they do that, so you don't salivate, okay? Because a lot of times for a long meditation, you're sitting there and then you start to drool or something like that. Then it kind of disturbs your meditation, right? So that's why they say that. And so we went to the back, legs, arms, hands, jaw, mouth, tongue, and eyes. Right? That's the posture. So let's do that. And what I want you to do is just start to get in the posture and start to just kind of relax your body. And you want to start by first scanning from toe to top of your head. Just know that your legs are there and relaxed, your arms, head, body, just kind of relax. And then start focusing on your breath. Deep breath in and out without too much effort. And then you just start focusing on your breath, either right at the nostril when it's going in or just at the abdomen. When the abdomen is extended, you can just focus just there. So if your mind starts to fleet or starts to go into some sort of pictures or images, no, let it be there. Just observe and just go back to your breathing. This is how you learn to concentrate. You develop concentration muscles, basically, so that you can focus on one thing. Again, if your mind starts to wander, just take a look at that, let it pass by, and get your mind back to your breath. So continue in that relaxed state, in a meditative mindset, and we're going to set the motivation. While you're meditating, just keep your ears open, keep your mind placid, and just listen and set the motivation along with me as I speak. So let's make an effort to ensure that the motivation for listening to the teachings and thinking about them is appropriate for this teaching, which is inspired by perfection of wisdom sutras that were provided to all the disciples of Buddha, especially those who seek supreme Buddhahood. Therefore, it is appropriate to generate a Mahayana motivation, taking the objective of oneself, achieving the states of supreme enlightenment, so that one will be a perfect cause for welfare of all living beings. In order to achieve that, it is necessary to gain a host of realizations, one of the most important of which is realization of the correct view of reality. In order to generate that, it is necessary to engage in those practices of listening, thinking, and meditating on the perfection of wisdom teachings. We are here now to practice listening to these teachings, which generate the wisdom of listening that supports the thinking about what was heard. This in turn produces the wisdom of thinking that supports the meditation on what is understood by that thinking. This in turn produces wisdom of meditation. It is through this path that we enter into Arya paths and ultimately achieve Buddhahood. So continue with a strong motivation to cultivate here, for being here today, and that will transform every effort you make here into a cause for you and even other living beings to experience the pacification of all misery and the perfection of every quality, including happiness. This ultimate objective is not beyond our ability to achieve. Buddhahood is defined as elimination of suffering and the cultivation of every quality, including happiness. The Buddha demonstrated this by attainment, that attainment is possible for everyone and anyone, and he taught his followers how to do it. The essence of those teachings is to cultivate enthusiastically disillusionments with cyclic life, altruism that does not exclude a single living being, and the view that perceives the non-inherent existence of everything. His teaching continues to the present, and we are here today to listen, to understand the teaching on how to cultivate that view. We are therefore engaged in the very act that ultimately results in Buddhahood. And once you achieve Buddhahood, you engage effortlessly and spontaneously in enlightening activity that results in everyone achieving Buddhahood. In this way, you're creating the cause for your own and everyone else's ultimate benefit. However, none of this can happen if you're not motivated to make it happen. If you're here merely to increase your knowledge so that you may be well thought of, or to sharpen your intelligence, so that you might find your way to some wealth, then you might succeed, but you will not be creating the causes for Buddhahood. As Buddhahood exceeds all accomplishments, ensures that your efforts here today are motivated to achieve it. Thank you. So that's a strong motivation. Okay? Everybody's, our goal is ultimately to reach Buddhahood, enlightenment, achieve liberation. And we're going to go through that. And I'm going to summarize today. Typically, I go through the summary, right? One by one, what we covered. I'm going to go through that just so we keep perspective on where we are, what we've learned, and maybe for some it will be a repetition, which is not so bad. It just kind of reemphasizes the points that we've covered. But we're going to put it in perspective. Why did we do this? Where are we going to? So that it kind of puts the entire picture of this particular module, which is module 12, the wisdom realizing emptiness, okay? And so for some it's basic, for some it may be good, but just keep patience, one of the virtues, okay? So we started the first class by introducing to establish the base by saying, okay, you need to give credit to the teachers. You know, if you write papers in your workplace or if you do something, you always have to give credit to the person that actually gave you the information, right? And it also is a confirmation or an affirmation that the teaching is not made up. It's not made up by me or somebody just sitting together in an office. It is authentic teaching, and it comes through lineage of masters or pundits or scholars. So it's important for you to know that, because that then gets your mind in a place where it says, okay, this is not somebody just paraphrasing something. There is some paraphrasing, but the actual teaching is authentic. This is, again, blessed by Lama Zopa Rinpoche, the FPMT leader. Okay? Then we said that you might need to get familiar with some names. These are basically a lot of the Indian Sanskrit names, and people struggle with them. But there are a few that they keep on coming up, because their names are all over, because there were schools established, they were scholars, they debated, and they came to some conclusions. So it's important to know who these people were. You don't have to memorize their name unless you want to get into advanced training or learning. It's important to know who are these people and what are their qualifications, right? So we need to know that. So for purposes of this class, some names that come to my mind, and if you are doing your readings, you will hear Chandrakirti. You will hear Dharmakriti. You'll hear the name Nagarjuna, okay, and Shantideva, Lama Tsongkhapa. You hear these names. And then, of course, they also mention their disciples or their students. Okay, the important thing to remember is this lineage, this teaching comes straight from Buddha. That's the important piece, right? That Buddha is the one who actually did these discourses, and then through great pundits like Nagarjuna, a lot of these teachings came down all the way to the monastery, to the monks, and to Geshe-la, and to us. So it's continuation of that teaching. Okay. And if you remember, in the first class we went through that Buddha gave 84,000 teachings, or they call them bundles, and they were categorized into three pieces. The first, or they call them baskets or bundles, and one was the bundle of discipline. So it gives you the discipline for the sangha. The second bundle was discourses or sutras. Okay, this is what we learn. This is what the teachings are. And then another third basket, just knowledge. Okay, so this is how they were divided. Then we start to understand that what is Mahayana and what is Hinayana, why these two divisions and all that. It's not. This is how you want to take a look at it. So the universal vehicle, which is Mahayana, which is FPMT, for preservation of Mahayana traditions. So this is what is, we are in Mahayana. And Hinayana, sometimes known as the individual vehicle, and Mahayana as the universal vehicle. And here's the differences. They both are inspired by Buddha's teachings, so no problem there. And the goal and the experience is to experience liberation. So we are fine there. Mahayana is motivated to become the cause for happiness of other living beings. We talk about bodhicitta all the time, right, in Mahayana. So that is their piece. Whereas the individual vehicle, or Hinayana, is geared, or those motivated by individual getting liberated. Okay? Certain way of looking at it. Whenever is individual-oriented for you, there are some limits, according to Mahayana, because you can get your merits all exhausted, and then you may have to return back and in the cycle again. But when you are completely engaged in helping others achieve Buddhahood, then it is not I-oriented, and it takes you to nirvana and beyond. And you still want to come back to help others because you're already poised in that state. Okay? These are the differences. Now, you don't have to do this or the other. Both are necessary. You need to understand that when you go through a high school, you need to learn from first grade to seventh grade in order to be in eighth, ninth, and tenth. So it's not about one being better than the other. You need all of that. So you need to understand what liberation is, what is it that I have to do, and then start to put into work, into practice, what I need to do as for bodhicitta, and then reach your Buddhahood. So try to understand that a little bit. Then we just talked a little bit in the first class about the importance of the Heart Sutra, the essence of what Buddha really taught on emptiness. And we didn't cover it in detail, but we mentioned it. And it specifically says it is very important to develop this wisdom. And we can cover that in a little better way. It is the mantras are used to protect one's mind. Mantra, one that protects the mind. Man means mind, tra, that which one that protects. So when people say do a mantra, or when you do recite your mantra on your rosary or on your mala, basically you're allowing your mind to focus on those words and what it means rather than going somewhere else. So it protects your mind. Mantra. Okay? And then we talked a little bit about the Heart Sutra mantra, Tayatha Gate Gate Paragate Parsamagate Bodhisoha. Today in the class I will go through the Heart Sutra in a little more detail than we went in the last two classes, so that you understand the concept of what it is. Okay? So very important. If it is the Heart Sutra, it is the essence of emptiness, then I think it deserves a little more scrutiny, time, than what I have given in the last two classes. So we're going to go through that. Then we learned a little bit about Nagarjuna and why it's important. We went through the four schools that during the time when in Nalanda University, tens and thousands of scholars used to come from China and from India and different places, and they used to study a specific discourse called Abhidharma. This is the area where a lot of these teachings come from. And they used to debate about emptiness especially. Abhidharma is about the pieces of emptiness. And they used to debate how things exist. And then there are different schools that started from thinking, oh, well, if things exist, then the smallest things must be atom, just like we would do it. You cut down things into smallest pieces, and you go down to atom. Then a little further, it went into the mind-only school, and they're saying, well, if it's in your mind, it doesn't really matter. Whatever you see is what is there. And it got a little more mature, and then eventually became, and a lot of these schools would have a tendency to take it on the extreme side, and then Nagarjuna debated all of these things and came up with the school that we follow, and it's called the middle way. You see Dalai Lama talking about the middle way. And the school is called Madhyamika Prasangika, which is, don't worry about the names. Madhyam means medium, middle. Okay? That's all it means. And if you can think, it's pretty close to medium, Madhyam. So that's the school we follow. And it's the middle way. They avoid the nihilistic way of thinking, nor things existing on their own as a solid and static. It's the middle way. Okay, and we will cover that in a little more detail. Just so you understand the four schools that we came through. Nagarjuna is the one from Madhyamika, and under him there are other groups with Chandrakirti, and we'll get to that a little bit later. But just so you know, you do not need to remember Nagarjuna right now unless you're taking higher level of education. You want to know the schools and what they taught and the tenets. Right now you need to know that this is direct lineage, and I will continue to show that even Lama Tsongkhapa, which is our lineage school of Gelug tradition of Tibetan master, even he confirms that when he asked Manjushri what is the correct way to learn, he was told, go the Nagarjuna way. So it's completely boiled down to a very nice way of teaching you. All right? You don't have to read books and books and books to understand that. That's what it comes down to. Again, the chapter 1 was establishing some lineage, and you should be a little familiar with that. Okay? Then we started covering things about accumulating merits and some traditions talking about avoiding sins. We use this word sin. Okay? We can call it non-virtuous actions. Sin. Okay? But accumulating merit can go only so far. It's wonderful to continue to accumulate merit, but know that the ultimate goal is what? To become Buddha. Go beyond all that. Because merits are like a bank balance. You know, it's so wonderful when you have a lot of money. People are friendly, you feel good. What happens when the money goes away? Back to zero. Nobody cares, nobody calls you. Same way, when the merits are diminished or lessened, then you start cycle again. So you must continue to have virtuous actions, is the point. Continue with that. But the ultimate goal is to liberate from all of this samsara or cyclic existence. Okay? So far okay? Okay? Alright. And the good thing is, Buddha can show you the way. The Four Noble Truths, right? The last. There's a path. He can show you the way. And so that's the authentication. Okay, then, at one point, even Lama Tsongkhapa, his statue is here. He's sitting behind here. And his two students is our teacher lineage. He's taught three aspects of the path, which you may have, some of you may have covered in the Discovering Buddhism. And those are renunciation, developing bodhicitta, and emptiness. And there's a whole class on that. What the point here is, he's saying that even though you may achieve renunciation and you can achieve bodhicitta, it is emptiness that you need to really, really understand to really liberate yourself. Right? So with correct view, enlightenment is guaranteed. And then we can go into a lot of discussion why and not. And remember in the first class, I don't know how many were you were here, some most of you were here, we talked about method and wisdom, the two wings of the Buddhism. We always talk about the two wings. If you see some of the deities or statues, you even see the vajra in the hand and a bell in one hand. Right? That represents wisdom and compassion, I mean wisdom and compassion. Okay? Two wings. So developing bodhicitta is the practice. What we do, we have to do. And what do we have to realize? The nature of reality. How things exist. And that's the emptiness. And we're going to go over that. So we stop the class by saying, well, think I must realize emptiness and no matter how long it takes. And you try to feel the spirit. So it establishes the base. Then we got into the second class and we talked about reciting Heart Sutra. We looked very clearly at ignorance. So we described what is ignorance. Ignorance is what we live in, not knowing the truth. Then we said the truth will set you free. Right? We say that here. So think about that. When you don't know something, then you are ignorant of something. Not in the conventional way, but this is in the understanding of emptiness, but also in the normal way, you can think of it that way. When you don't know something, you simply are ignorant of what it is. So, but ignorance, what we are talking about, is the root of all the problems. And ignorance is not knowing how things exist. And what it does, all kind of crazy things, and we're going to cover through the summary, how ignorance begins the cycle of the attachment, the aversion, the anger, all the feelings and everything that we just layer over layer over layer, and how it begins. Okay? And then we kind of talked about, you know, if somebody were to ask you when you were dying, who are you? Right about before death, who are you? What would you say? And we said, you know, what will come to your mind? So we'll cover that little again, probably a little duplicative, but I'll just mention the fact. Your mind will go or cling to what it's familiar with at that time. You've been practicing all your life something, working, jobs, family, whatever it is. It will go to something that you're clinging on, money, property, whatever it is, what will happen. Also, you don't know what is next to come. So there's a fear. right? And that's what we live with. We live with fear. And so that's what it's saying, that if you practice throughout the life virtuous actions, and there are even yogis that have such a conviction that they know exactly where they're going. They have such a practice every single day that they can completely, single-pointedly, can they have conviction that they are going to a positive place. That's how much practice that they do, because they don't identify with anyone else. And in the end it said, if nothing, take refuge. But to take refuge, you need to understand what it is, and that you must practice it and believe it and have conviction in it. So these are the ways they teach you. And this is not some sort of a preaching. This is what they're saying is, these are options you have. And they're giving you some logical way of thinking that what will go with you, if you believe that will go. But you must challenge it, you must analyze it, you must look at it and see if it makes sense. And where does the mind go right now? When you're sitting down, you're listening. But when you're in your normal activity, where does it travel? Some of the thoughts that our mind creates are embarrassing. Some are positive, some are great. We also have people that are neutral. They kind of don't worry about things. They're okay, no problem. They don't get too excited. That's a wonderful thing, actually, a good quality. But if you go with a mind, a goal, a wish, then that's where you are working towards. That's the journey you want to be on. So you got to do it with a happy heart. This is not a class after you're tired and you're thinking like, oh gosh, I got to study this now. That's not the point here. You got to think about, see the excitement when you buy a new house? Or when you're buying a new car? How excited do we get? Right? We read up, Google it, we look at the brand, the color, the inside, the outside, well, how are you going to decorate it? Well, how about decorating your mind that way? So that's the point. They're just trying to make a point here, that what you practice will go with you. So it's great to have virtuous friends, because that's the seed you will then carry with you. And you will not have that fear of dying. Okay? So that's the point we were trying to make. I guess we got into a lot of discussion on when you're meditating, you can do calm abiding and analytical, and you have to find the balance between the two. There are different types of people. There are people who are completely out of faith. If somebody tells them, the teacher tells them, do this, they will just do it. They won't even question it. Then there are others, and I know a few of us, who have to find out why. Who said it? What does it mean? I don't believe it. Right? We start with that. And then you have to be convinced in your mind. But most people have both in it. A little bit of trust because of practices and a little bit of doubt. And that's perfectly fine. You need to allow that. But then you must do something to then negate or accept the fact. You must come to some conclusion if you want to take the journey. You have to buy the ticket and sit on the train to go. Otherwise you can think the train leaving, but you're not going to reach there. So then we talked about, you know, you have to, we talked about Lam Rim, which is the Tibetan word of the stages to the path, which Lama Tsongkhapa wrote. He then abbreviated the path to 25 verses. And in the end, he said, after doing all of those things and meditating, he was so accomplished and so attained that he said, these are his words, he said that he did what Buddha asked him. And what did Buddha say? Lama Tsongkhapa tells us that what the Buddha said was required to achieve liberation and enlightenment. He's telling you, this is the way you're going to do it. And he said, he did it, and you should too. Okay? So it again brings the importance of knowing what is emptiness. Okay? And then, of course, we talked about it in our motivation, that you must listen, you must think, and then meditate. And why you must listen? You're accumulating some things. Then you must think it out. You analyze it. Now you have something to meditate on. Right? Otherwise, what are you meditating on if you don't know what you're thinking about? So those three things are important. And by depending upon these, you have a clearer understanding. Okay? Then we picked ignorance in different aspects all throughout the last three or four classes. Okay, what is ignorance? And so here, we talk about ignorance here. This is a very beautiful words that I want to read. It says, ignorance here is not a passive absence of knowledge. It's an active misknowledge or misconception of reality. Right. Make sense? Okay. And sometimes in the conventional life, our mind does bizarre things, right? We had that example of a person thought he had a $20 bill in his pocket. He goes to buy something for $19.95. He goes in his wallet and takes out it's a $10 bill. Right? So what happened? His mind misapprehended what was in his wallet. Right? You know, maybe he didn't plan because it was some emotional thing, or just what. But our mind does that sometimes. It does mistakes. But the good thing about mind is it also corrects. And why is this important? Because when you think about how we actually are living, and when we are talking about emptiness, you need both. You see every day everything that we do, then we are telling ourselves, this is not good according to this teaching. I shouldn't be doing that. So what's the correct way? While it's doing those things, it's also recognizing what it should be doing. So that's how our mind works. It apprehends. It wants to know that it wants to have knowledge. Right? So sometimes what happened in the case of 1995, and it's just basically a mental event that wrongly engages. Simple as that. And we correct it. And we can be fooled. And we can be fooled for many reasons. Afflicted mind, medicine, maybe took too many Ambien pills. Okay? It could be many things. A sick state, disease state, that can sometimes mind is not working good. So we are prone to those mistakes. But the good thing is our mind can also correct itself. It can look at something and think, yep, that makes sense. Yeah, that doesn't make sense. It will go through that process. So that's the good news. And then our mind does funny things according to Dharmakriti here. He's a logician. That's all it was. He was epistemologist. Things they look at very logical way of thinking. He basically says that people perceive things, whatever comes in their head, and then they see some. So for example, you could take a look at a bush at night and say, you saw a person there because the light was bad, or your emotional state at the time, or you were watching a TV and you thought, oh, I think I see a guy over there, like a mirage. Or it could be internal. Like I said, you could be sick, you could have taken some medicine, and you can see things. But then next day you go and say, oh, geez, that's a bush. No, it was crazy mind there. But you corrected yourself. He's just saying that's how mind does things. That's all basically saying. And he says that the cause of cyclic existence is ignorance, which is the only misconception, a misconception. It's something that can be eliminated by anyone. So it is preparing you to understand the wisdom of emptiness. To know that what we do is in the mode of ignorance, and if you remove ignorance, and the way you remove ignorance, so first you have to ask, what is ignorance? Ignorance is not knowing. Not knowing what? The true nature of things. Reality. You need to know what is real. When you don't know what is real, you live in a mode of this ignorance. So if you remove the ignorance and you know the reality, wow, you have liberated yourself. The difficulty is, for life after life, we continue to have these layers and layers and layers of habituated mind. And the good thing is you are sitting here today learning about it. That's a wonderful start. Geshe-la says, even if you hear these things about emptiness, one time it shatters ignorance. It really puts it in its place. It's a beginning. It's not going to be that you're going to walk out of this room and be perfectly realizing emptiness. It takes time, because it's one thing to theoretically know these concepts. It's another thing to truly understand it, meditate on it, and see it all the time. Then the second stage is we always objectify. We look at other things and find emptiness in that. Oh, I can see this pillow is not a pillow, it has a cloth on it, it's a sponge in it, it's maroons, it came for something. But we forget us. We are part of that. And so then we go into the learning about emptiness. But anyways, what ignorance causes, and you've heard of the 12 links, right? Everybody is familiar with 12 links? Okay, the 12 links, and I'll go through that again. This is how we come into birth and death cycle. So you start with ignorance. You're not knowing what things are. So it creates, you see something, and you say, oh, that's a nice thing. You know, I know what that is, that's a pillow. And then our mind says, oh, that's a pillow. Oh, it's a round pillow. It's a burgundy color. I wish it was orange. I think it's soft. I think it needs cleaning. Our mind immediately starts to layer things. So the ignorance causes this. We give it a name, and then all of a sudden, we make it real. Then we start to layer. We start developing feelings. Then we have contact. And then what happens? We cling on to things we like. And we hate things where we have aversion. It's another form of attachment. We do that with our friends, don't we? We do that with our, even, look at our things, we material things. So we find something, good job, good paycheck, you buy something new, you're happy. I say, I don't need to be more happy, I'm happy right now. Then what happens after the first ding on the car, or something gets old, the paint starts to peel off, it's not the same excitement like it was when you first bought it. So those are temporary happiness. And what do? We cling. Because now that you've created layer of feeling and contact, and oh, it's beautiful, and I do this, I do that, it's okay, but just think how we cling. And then when we cling, what happens when their life is coming to an end? You can only go to those things that you like. And then we jump from one temporary happiness to another. So now the car is old, the home is old, maybe we should look for another one. Right? So we do that. And it's not saying wrong or right, it's just how our mind works. And we find our temporary happiness throughout our lives, and we think things are peachy, pretty good. Till sickness comes, or the day you find out you gotta be in hospital next 3 days, and you may have maybe 2 weeks left. Now what happens? That house doesn't come in, the strolls in the malls don't appear to you. You're now concerned. And then the only way, even you're sitting there, you can think about all the things you did, all the things you liked, your mind will go to what it's familiar with. So we are trying to learn what should you really know and become familiar with so you don't cling on to those things, so you can take the root of this birth and death cycle, then you can reach to nirvana. That's why we learn emptiness. Okay? And then, of course, one of the other ignorant factors is anger. We create aversion, we like attachment to good things, but then when we don't like it, we can even create anger towards somebody. And then all anger is complete, is a total disillusionment. It's totally negative. It harms you, it harms others. Okay? Even if you think of somebody political, and you think, I can't stand that guy, or this person, or you may love the person, you have two thoughts, people who love, people who don't like. But the person is not inherently negative. They still have good qualities. They're not inside. They don't just manufacture themselves as bad people. But they have afflictions due to their karmic cycles and other needs and attachments that create some of those negative things. So we can recognize those, but you can inherently fault somebody as a bad person, period, according to Buddhism. This is not Hemant speaking. Okay, well, it says here, well, there is nobody who is inherently faulty. They have ignorance that's driving some of the things how we perceive as fault. Okay? So we've gone through clinging attachment, personal identity, when you die, what do you think of, how we cling on to things. We've gone through the alternative about people being neutral, and that's perfectly fine. And will I recognize myself after a great fate of death? And what do I do? These are some of the questions that we had addressed. And it's an inspiration for what you become when the mind leaves your body at death. You can become anything. Whatever you feed, you can kind of lead to the next existence a certain way. So this is why developing that bodhicitta and virtuous mindset is very important. And then understanding the reality so you know what your goal is. You understand you want to become a Buddha, so it's telling you no reality, how things exist, and while you're living in this conventional world, create virtuous action. You're training your mind. And when you're creating virtuous actions for others, you're not putting I in it. You're doing for others without any expectations. That mind is a fantastic, and that's what we call bodhicitta, and bodhisattvas do that. They generate compassion just like that. Very hard. And Geshe-la says, this is a hard concept for people when you're struggling yourself, so be kind to yourself first. Develop compassion for yourself first, then start slowly and go outwards. But it doesn't say that you have to pack up your bags and start feeding people or giving money to people. You develop a wish that everybody gets enlightened. You develop that mindset. That's the first thing you do. Develop a wish, which you can practice. Right? So, everybody okay so far? Okay? Okay. And then we went into class 3. And so, the first class, lineage. Second class, we talked about ignorance and understanding what it does. And the reason for all that is the whole idea is to remove ignorance. And what is ignorance? Ignorance doesn't, if you don't see the reality the way things are, that is ignorance. Okay? And so then what we do is now we are saying, okay, if we always look at other things, let's bring it internal. How about us? That big I. Okay? So we did a 4-point analysis. Correct? We did a 4-point analysis, and what is the point of that 4-point analysis? We are looking for what is that clinging, that attachment, that big I that is afraid, that says, this is me, this is I. And so they say, okay, some people may say, I am this body, and there's something in there that is the awareness. So the 4-point analysis looks at identifying the person as it is misconceived by ignorance. The second point looks at deciding if that person existed the way it's misconceived, then it must be findable, either in relationship to the body or in relationship to the mind. Because sometimes we say, oh, it's a package. It's my mind and this, what you see is me, as we come to that. But logically, you need to look at it very carefully, and we'll talk a little bit about it. And then the last 2 points are very easy. It's saying, proving that such a person is not findable in relationship to the body and mind complex, and proving that such a person is not findable independent of the body and mind complex. So it's looking for things. Where is that I that we call me? Okay? This is a very hard concept for people because we live a lot, our whole world is around ignorance, I-oriented, me-oriented. It is so real for us. But then they go into, when you do your readings, you'll find that they're attacking the same point from different angles, different examples, so many ways to just point to you that there is no such thing. Okay? And that's the whole idea of the 4-point analysis. Matter of fact, class 6, the next class, the last class, is a practice class. This is the 5th class. We're going to go through a detailed 4-point analysis, and we'll look for that eye. You know? Let's see if you can find it. And I'm telling you right now, some of you may have doubts in your mind. Because there's still, our ego is not going to let you go that easily. It's been too habituated by thinking, I, me. This is me, my name. I'm Hemant. This is my shirt. This is my pants. I'm sitting here. I see you every day. What's the problem? That's how we think. And the point of emptiness is going to lead you through systematically to show you things do exist. However, they do not exist inherently. This concept, you must have it in your head. There's a distinct difference between these two. Because what happens when you say things don't exist, then you go to zero. Everything is void. I don't want to be a Buddha if nothing exists. There's a fear in you. What is it? What exists then? These are minds. Our mind is going to question all these things. So you need to first clearly understand, to be logical in your mind, that things appear, but when you really look at it, they do not exist inherently. They exist conventionally. And if you heard in the 4th class, Venerable Rubina, she says it in a very nice way, better than I can ever say. She goes and says, we've made a contract with everybody. We're going to call this a book. And we're going to call this a cup. We made a contract. And so everybody kind of understands that this is a cup. So then I look at this cup. It exists. It is there right in front of me. So then now the mind has to look at it saying, okay, so our mind has labeled, and we all agree that we're going to call this a cup. So that's why it's a cup. If we all had agreed that this was a holder, not a cup, then we would, if I use the word cup, you would say, what the heck are you talking about? It's a different language. Because I only recognize the holder, right? It all comes with naming and thought and how we label things. Conventionally, we agree. What does convention mean? We agree. We come to some sort of a contractual agreement. These are eyes and these are my ears. Okay, this is a beard. That's a cup. So things do exist that way. But now what emptiness is saying is when you go at a deeper level, just know that this is dependent arising. Right? There's a clay. There's a ceramic. There's a color. Probably some sand. It goes on and on. Then you break the clay down to some small particles, has atoms, has nanoparticles probably, has some electrons in it. It can go on and on and on. Then are those particles the cup? Or what is the cup? So we must agree that when, if you're looking for a cup, and I can say this is a cup, but you also have a picture in your mind that there are other things called cups. When you want to drink something, which cup are you going to use? All the cups or this cup, right? So don't get confused with this. All I'm trying to say is the way to see dependent arising, everything, the entire phenomena is dependent arising. Just go look. Look at anything you want to, including yourself. You don't exist inherently. Dependent arising means causes and effects. Causes and effects. Each thing leads to another. It's just the nature of phenomena. Okay? Oh, you were stretching. If you want to wait, there, let me just finish this, or maybe we can write it down. Be more than happy to. I want to have a lot of covering. I'll be happy to answer the question, or we can discuss it. But just at least understand one thing. If you take anything away, without going into a lot of logic and show me and prove me, just go to one thing. Things are dependent arising, and the word emptiness are synonymous, essentially, except for the labels, right? And because of our English language, empty means void of something. There's no water in it, it's empty of water. That's why we think of void. Okay? But all we are saying is, it is dependent arising. Okay? And what is dependent arising? Causes and effects that just keeps on going on. Moment to moment. Even a flame of a candle, when you're looking at the flame, that is not the same flame as the previous moment. Moment to moment, that flame, how about yourself? Are you the same person when you were 16 years old or 15 years old? You're not. Are you the same person you were yesterday? You're changed. Yourselves have changed. Your hairs have changed. Some have fallen off, like mine do. Right? So we change. Every moment we are changing. And that's all it's saying, that people who are completely poised see reality in a very different way. But when you're ignorant and we have attachments, we give names and labels and then we attach to that. A beautiful room, a tall room, a cold room, a hot room, handsome, ugly, whatever. We start to put layers and layers and layers. And people who understand, they see it as is. So that's the point I'm trying to make. So if you don't want to say the word emptiness is itself such a convoluted word, empty of what? It doesn't mean nothing exists. Things come and our conventional mind labels it, so we see it that way. Otherwise, everything is dependent origin. It is always so many things. Let's take an example of the rainbow. You see a rainbow. It'd be nice, it looks beautiful, we take pictures of rainbow. But does rainbow exist? You have to ask. Then you can say, if you're scientific minded, oh, it's the light hitting the water molecules that reflects the rainbow. It's a mere label. It is just a reaction of other things. And even that light and that the water molecules, they themselves are dependent origin, right? They arise from something else. Look at anything. It is like an hallucination, and our mind projects these things as real. So don't be scared. Don't get scared, like, what the heck exists then, right? We will talk about that. And it's very interesting when you get little detail into it, and I don't think so that I can do justice in 5 classes. You have to take some responsibility to meditate, to read, to question it, to tear this apart, till it settles in your mind, and you will find in the end you will lose fear. Actually, it's exciting after a while. People get goosebumps when they first get, wow, this is really amazing. And you will see once you recognize how things exist, how ignorance goes. When somebody says something, it's not going to phase you the way it normally phases you because there is no big I in it. Who are you to tell me? You know, he did not respect me. She was a little too loud. All that goes away. It neutralizes very quickly. Right? It's a great therapy. Okay? So, then we did meditation on I. We did a whole bunch of examples of the cup and the cupness and all this kind of stuff. And then, let's see. Okay, so this is 7:55. I do want to go through the Heart Sutra. So we went through the Heart Sutra, and we talked about Heart Sutra as the essence of Buddha's teaching for emptiness. And to clarify these points that we are talking about, sometimes when you read Heart Sutra and it says you have no sound, no eye, no tongue, people are like, what are you talking about? So let's go through that a little bit. But before you go into learning Heart Sutra, there are a couple of things you should know. And we're going to define those things. There was a question from the class, what are 5 aggregates? Okay? So let's talk about that 5 aggregates. Well, I'll define it in a little more detail. I will go through them right away so I can explain that to you. So when you say 5 aggregates, sometimes they use word the heap. Okay, a heap of aggregates. They use these words when you look it up. And it's like, what is a heap and what's an aggregate? So the word, Sanskrit word for aggregate is called skanda. Skanda means collection. That's all it means, collection of these things. What are they? Form. Matter, form, feelings, okay, discrimination or perception, then mental formations, and I'll explain you what each one is, and consciousness. Think about all this. Form, feelings, discrimination or perception, mental formation or compositional factors, they use different words, and consciousness, the 5 aggregates, according to definitions. Form or matter is a body or material form of being existence made of 4 basic elements, earth, water, fire, and wind. Matter. Okay? Sensations or feelings, sensory experiences of an object. Beautiful pillow, nice table, that kind of stuff, right? Perception or discrimination. These are also sensory and mental processes that registers and recognizes and labels the colors, the emotion, the shape. You know, that's a round. Oh, I like round stuff. Triangle. Oh, I like things that are like that. We start to develop these layers. Okay? So those are your perceptions. And everybody has a different perception. If I bet you show somebody the same thing and everybody will have a little, oh, I like it, I don't like it. Oh, it's too tall, it's too short. We all have different perceptions. So those are perceptions. Mental formations. Now you're going to do some activities, karma, activities. I'm going to buy that pillow. I'm going to go to the mall. I'm going to develop an action behind it. So there are a couple of things. Everything that's mentally done is kind of put into this bucket called mental formation. And what it says is, it's constructing activities, conditions, things, power of choosing or determining, karmic activities, such as all types of mental imprints conditionally triggered by an object. It elicits action to it. And the last thing is consciousness, which is awareness.
Consciousness is the same as mind.
Yes. Synonymous. It's amazing, Tibetans don't say, they say mind. They put their hand here. The Westerners put their mind here, like a brain. Oh, my mind. The Tibetans will say, my mind. It's amazing to just see the differences. So, conscious awareness of an object, discrimination of its components, aspects, and cognizance. Just knowing. Those are five aggregates. Another thing you need to know is when you become a bodhisattva, when you sit on that train, that now you're going to want to become enlightened. You come to conclusion that I want to become enlightened. So you're going to sit on this train and you're going to go through these five paths. This is what bodhisattvas go through. The path of accumulation, the path of preparation, the path of seeing, the path of meditation, and path of no more learning. Why am I going through this? Because when we look at the Heart Sutra, you will see how important that Heart Sutra is. All of these things are in there. Okay? So far so good. I'm not losing anybody. Am I off target? I just want to take the pulse here. Are we all okay? Too fundamental? Okay? And then you should always check yourself when you read these books. At least I do that. When I don't understand something, it's kind of useless to read the whole paragraph when you're missing a word. I look it up. I'll ask a question. Even words like, what's a phenomena? What's a bodhisattva? What's a bodhicitta? What is a Buddha? We always get this little nice feeling like Buddha means enlightened. What does that even mean? You know, is it good, bad? Do I like it? Gotta go through that. And that's the homework you should have. You should, when you're reading something, question it. And then when you come to a conclusion, you have a conviction. That it makes it happy. Also, you need to understand that at all times, when you're on the train and you're a bodhisattva, you're always practicing these six perfections. Okay? Everybody knows those, right? What is the first one? Patience. Or is it? Generosity. Second one is morality. Third one is patience. Fourth one is joyful effort. Then concentration and wisdom. And wisdom is, what is wisdom? Knowing emptiness, understanding emptiness, the last stage. So practicing this at all times. It doesn't have to be money all the time. Patience can be practiced. Generosity can be practiced. Helping. Giving your time, you are being generous today to me. Right? You can look at it that way. Morality, have some good, virtuous, moral thoughts. Third thing, you have to have, of course, patience, big virtue, right? If you wait and you seek, you find patience of letting somebody else speak. All of those things are ways to practice those things. You need to have joyful effort. If you're going to get and become a Buddha, you need to have enthusiasm in you, wanting to learn these things. Wanting to understand it, right? You need to have that. When you come to this center, you drive, you want to get excited. I could be very boring, but if you take few things away and it makes a change in your life, wow. Right? That's enthusiasm. You have to develop concentration. So that's why we tell you, we can speak here all day long and you can read all five books and every reading that you give you. But if you don't meditate on it, if you don't think about it, then it's not going to put a strong imprint in your mind, right? Because you can right now sit and talk about it and say, well, that makes sense. Well, that sounds like a good thing. But then we go away. Then tomorrow it's like, yeah, we kind of talked about emptiness and he talked about all these names and stuff, right? It goes away. You have to make an effort to say, what was it that we're talking about and why? Why do I need to know emptiness? How will it take me to Buddhahood? Now you have a little new house. I want to know how the heater works and how the carpet, what kind of carpet we're going to put on it. And so that's the kind of enthusiasm you need. And then you develop this concentration and ultimately you reach wisdom. Then you become Buddha. and you can do it. Okay? So these are important things. So we understand the five aggregates. We understand the five paths, the path of accumulation, preparation, seeing, meditation, and no more learning. All these are as you're becoming Buddha, the Bodhisattvas practice these things in different stages. And I will connect this with the Heart Sutra now. Okay? So I want you to do is open page 76 of your prayer book, gold prayer book, and let's read through that. We have a little half an hour, we can go through this. Page 76. It's called the Heart of Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. It starts in the middle of the page. Can we read that loudly, all together, okay? So it says, I prostrate to the Arya Triple Gem. Thus did I hear at one time, the Bhagwan was dwelling on a mass of Vultures Mountain in Rajgriha, together with great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. At that time, the Bhagwan was absorbed in the concentration on the categories of phenomena called profound perception. Also at that time, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara looked upon the very practice of the profound perfection of wisdom and beheld these five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Then through the power of Buddha, the Venerable Shariputra said this to Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, how should any son of this lineage train who wishes to practice this activity of the profound perfection of wisdom? He said that, and the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara said, this to Saradivacaputra. Sariputra, any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice this activity of profound perfection of wisdom should look upon it like this, correctly, repeatedly, beholding those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. For form is empty, emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form is also not other than emptiness. In the same way, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness are empty. Sariputra, likewise, all phenomena are emptiness, without characteristics, unproduced, unseized, stainless, not without stain, not deficient, not fulfilled. Sariputra, therefore in the emptiness there is no form, no feelings, no discrimination, no compositional factors, no consciousness. No eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. No visual form, no sound, no odor, no taste, no object of touch, and no phenomena. There is no eye element, and so on up to and including no mind element, and no mental consciousness element. There is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, and so on, up and including no aging, death, and no extinction of aging and death. Similarly, there is no suffering, origination, cessation, path, and there is exalted wisdom, no attainment, and also non-attainment. Sariputra, therefore, because there is no attainment, bodhisattvas rely and dwell on this perfection of wisdom, the mind without obscuration and without fear. Having completely passed beyond error, they reach the end of point of nirvana. All the Buddhas who dwell in these three realms also manifestly complete awaken to unsurpassable, perfect, complete enlightenment in reliance of perfection of wisdom. Therefore, the mantra of perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the mantra equal to the unequal, the mantra that thoroughly pacifies all suffering, should be known as the truth, since it is not false. The mantra of perfection of wisdom is declared, Tayatha, Gate Gate, Paragate, Parsamgate, Bodhisoha. Sariputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, should train in the profound perfection of wisdom like that. Then the Bhagwan arose from that concentration and commended the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, saying, well said, son of the lineage, it is like that. It is like that. One should practice the profound perfection of wisdom just as you have indicated, even the Tathagatas rejoice. The Bhagwan having thus spoken, the Venerable Sarivadputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, and those surrounding in the entirety, along with the world of gods, humans, asuras, gandharvas, were overjoyed and highly praised that spoken by Bhagwan. So it sounds like, you know, there are some very strong statements in there, so we need to look at that a little bit closer, okay? So give me a moment here. Here it is. Okay, good. Okay, just want to make sure my notes are with me. Okay, so the first part of the mantra, or the, I mean the sutra, starts with a prologue. Prologue means introduction. Okay? So, there are two parts, common and uncommon prologue. So there are two parts. It's important to know that and with regard to the common prologue, that has four parts in it. The first is the excellence of time. It starts with the word, thus did I hear one time. So it's just confirming that this is coming all the way from as it was. It's just one of those confirmations. Then the second one is the excellence of the teacher. Well, Buddha himself was there. Right? So, and it's very important because it says the excellence of the teacher is established because the teacher was in fact Lord Buddha, and because of his excellence, he possesses all of the high and excellent attributes and qualities. And he has transcended both samsara and nirvana. So you're talking about the most qualified, enlightened being there. The third excellence is the place, Rajgira. And Rajagira, all it means is, Raja means king, Griha means the home of. It's just a good location. The fourth is the excellence of the audience. They're talking about bhikshus, dandavas, bodhisattvas were all present. So you can imagine bodhisattvas are such, before you become Buddha, you are a bodhisattva. At the highest level, they were present. And that is what there's a conversation between the two disciples, Avalokiteshvara and then Sariputra. So the uncommon prologue was, at that time, the Bhagavan or the Buddha was absorbed in a concentration on categories of the phenomena called profound perception. The word profound here is emptiness. Highest level profound. So again, it says it's called profound because it's something deep and it's very hard to understand right away. So it's very profound. Okay? And then, of course, the appearance is subject and object. When you're looking at something, that's the object, and when you're looking at it, you're the subject, like that. So they're just saying that this is how everything was collected, and he was completely concentrated on profound wisdom. Okay. So that's the main thing. So now the actual sutra. So here, the Shariputra is asking the question. So here's the important piece is that his profound presence impacted how Avalokiteshvara and Sariputra started this conversation, because he was concentrating on emptiness. So you can see the effect of the environment. Okay, so here's the first one. It says here, then through the power of Buddha, the Venerable Sariputra said this to Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, how should the son of lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of profound perfection of wisdom? That's the question. So again, here it again shows the power of Buddha that inspired this conversation. And only through inspiration, this conversation took place. So this is the answer. He said that the Bodhisattvas, Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, said this to Venerable Sariputra, any son of lineage or daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice the activity of profound perfection of wisdom should look upon like this correctly, repeatedly, beholding those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. So now you know what five aggregates are? Form, feelings, perception, okay, discrimination or perception, mental formation, and consciousness are empty of inherent existence. It'll make, at least you link now the five aggregates, right? Okay. So, remember I told you the five paths, how bodhisattvas go through path of accumulation. So when Avalokiteshvara is answering, he's also talking two different levels. He's talking to an advanced level group. He's also talking in the most mundane level, ordinary way. That's how he's explaining these things. And he's going to take you through those five paths, basically. In this entire thing is linked to those five paths. So the first one, for example, is the path of accumulation and preparation. And so it says the way to traverse this five paths. So he's going to go through that. The second section is to accomplish the path of seeing. The third one. The fourth one is the path of meditation. And the last one is path of no more learning. And you can see as you're going through this, you can see where that's coming from. Okay, you can see how each paragraph in the Heart Sutra is linked to those paths, is how I should say it. Okay, so let's look at that. So first one says, form is empty, emptiness is form, emptiness is not other than form, form is also not other than emptiness. In the same way, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors and consciousness are empty. Here's your lesson on emptiness, right? We've been talking about things are dependent arising, they do not exist inherently, and here he's telling you what it is. So think about this for a second. Form is empty, and emptiness is form. So what is it empty of, the form? Inherent existence. It's because the living people like us do not realize that they believe the form inherently exists. And then we generate this attachment and aversion, and then the whole thing starts, right? Inherent existence is different. Go ahead, please.
Is it because of this misconception that discrimination is created?
In the context of here, discrimination is good, bad, short, long, however mind discriminates with objects and things, that discrimination.
Okay, but so if discrimination is also...
It's a mental factor.
Empty, meaning that it's not inherently existent. It's dependent on causes and conditions. So that's why my earlier... question, is it because the mind misapprehend phenomenon that this discrimination arises?
Okay, so first you have to go back. You have to then question yourself, does mind exist on its own volition, on its own? Or is it a, so?
According to this, consciousness is also
empty.
Dependent arising.
Everything is dependent arising.
Right.
So as soon as we create a thought, as soon as a thought comes due to causes and conditions or through naming convention and language, we create, in a conventional way, we create a name and a thought. And that starts the link of I like it, I don't like it, it is good, it is bad. Right? So that is the discrimination. And what it's saying is, and I'm going to go through this here, so we're going to discuss that so give me 1 second. So let's go through this and then we'll go to that point. Okay? So it's saying here that because we are ignorant of this, the problems arise from this. To eliminate this fault, it is taught that the form is empty. Mm-hmm. Empty means what? Dependent arising. Form is dependent arising. So you got to think about that for a second. What does that mean? Form is dependent arising. So you got to mull that a little bit. So when we are told that the form is empty of true existence or lacks inherent existence, there's a possibility of falling into the wrong view of nihilism. That is thinking that because form lacks any true or inherent existence, it doesn't exist at all. This confuses people. Because what we say and how it is described, but this is very good because it challenges you, your mind. So let's think about this for a second. If we don't do anything else, we need to focus on this. What does this mean? Okay. To eliminate this error of nihilism, that nothing exists, the second statement says the emptiness is form. What is emptiness then? Dependent arising. This phenomena is entirely dependent arising. All the things that go on in the phenomena are dependent arising. That creates the form. That is the form itself. And what happens is our mind isolates something and we label it. Okay? And it's hard for me to even explain it in an easier way. I sometimes think myself, this is not the teaching, this is him speaking. I personally see it that like a water flowing, you know, and then we see foam coming up, foam coming down, forms come up, foams come up. It's just part of the, wherever it hits, whatever it picks up, it continues to just keep changing. right? It's not being created on its own. It's just whatever that causes and conditions are, and whatever it picks up the color of the dirt. Sometimes it goes on the beach and just kind of fizzles out. So it does what it does. Similarly, phenomena is cause and effect, continuously of cause and effect, and causes and conditions that things appear or happen in the phenomena. Continuously. So many rainbows come up. We are born. We will die. Plants come up. Seeds grow into trees. Trees die. It continuously causes and conditions everything. The only way we can express that, because we are not realizing emptiness, is through object like trees and grass and cup and cupness and all that. They keep on giving example. But you got to really think about this, that emptiness means dependent, is synonymous with dependent arising. Okay? It's not out there. It is everything. It is not dual. It is not me and that. It is not I and emptiness. It's all, everything inclusive. Includes you, includes entire phenomena, is empty of inherent existence. It is all dependent arising. Think about it for a second. Allow that to settle in your mind. And it's saying things come into play because of dependent arising. It is not like empty like space, for example, just in a mundane language. It's not like void. Things come, things happen. All of these things that happen, all the activities, it's all causes and conditions. So things do come. It's just that our mind does not see it as is. We have to label it. And then that becomes real. And I give you an example. If somebody called this a holder, and there was never a word called cup in English, and then you come and say, oh, that's a cup, everybody else would not know what you're talking about. Is that we have conventionally given it a title, cup. Same way, all the forms, all the things, everything is created through language and thought and naming conventions in our mind. That's why Buddhists will say it's like a hallucination. It's like an illusion.
And so nothing is outside of that.
Right, nothing. It is phenomena. You cannot say the universe is separate from the phenomena of this earth. There are different phenomena, but in the scope of the phenomena, that is the way it is. Everything is dependent arising. And that's why the form is also part of the phenomena. And that's why, because of emptiness and because of things are changing, you have form. Otherwise, there is no form. Think about it. If everything was a form, you can't see the differences, right? It would exist statically. These changes cause us to see the changes.
Which of these aggregates, to me, the physical aggregates, is not form. Which of these aggregates come from the mind?
So if you think about the feelings.
I mean, yeah, the feeling comes from the mind. Yeah. So the only ones that do not come from the mind would be the form.
Form. Even the form. If you really want to understand emptiness, of course, I'm not going to go into, you can read further, that even form is a label that we've given to a shape.
Right. But the shape.
Right.
Is dependent upon causes and conditions that are physical. Right? Or is there a mental factor that creates the physical?
You are not creating anything. It is the nature of the phenomena. Whatever the causes and conditions, either mentally you create or whatever the forces are outside, it's impacting on what it is that it becomes.
So what we're saying here is that there is this, there are these aggregates that are emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are these aggregates that are physical or form.
Mm-hmm.
And then these other that are mental, discrimination, and then consciousness. And so they're beginningless. They have arisen because of previous moments of causes and conditions.
Causes and effects, right?
Yeah.
So they're telling you in a very nice way, form, feelings, and then the mental factors of discrimination, good, bad, ugly, shape, color, all that, that part of the faculty. Then they talk about any activities you do because of that. And then the consciousness, which is the awareness. Everything is dependent arising.
Okay, so then my question, the following question is, logically, is the consciousness, the mind, perceives all these phenomena, and because it perceives it and labels it, you know, the way it wants to, you know, whatever interpretation it wants to give or, you know, whatever, that's irrelevant. The point is that what I'm trying to, like, understand or land is that there are these aggregates, and is the consciousness, is the mind that perceives those and labels them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it says anger, happiness, fear.
Correct.
Blue, white.
Right.
Okay.
So remember we talked about this earlier. Mind has two ways. It is living habitually, but it also cognizes. Well, once you learn something, it's able to see, and you're working through your mind right now, then what is emptiness? What is dependent arising? So it cognizes that. So it all happens here, of course, as you're in a human body right now, conventionally. But the phenomena itself is creating that. It's we just label it. It's the nature of the phenomena.
To me, it's very clear. I have that experientially understand the dependent arising.
So stop right there. So dependent arising.
Yeah. Cause and condition.
So even those words are that we use a lot. So a cause has an effect. Right?
Yes.
Right? Cause ceases, effect rises.
Yes.
Which then causes another cause for another effect. Right? Causes and conditions. And like I said, you need, for seed to grow, you not only need to put the seed and know that it will one day grow, and we can label it, it may look like this, we can make it up, but it has to have sunlight, water, all so many factors for that seed to even flourish. Some seeds will die, but the one with the right causes and conditions may flourish. Right? So then it's the nature of the phenomena is everything is dependent arising,
yes,
including you.
Yes.
Even your the mind that you're talking about.
Yes.
What is mind? We use the word mind. What is mind? Awareness.
Yes.
Okay? So then you think about the moments to moments how mind is working. Previous moment?
Yes.
Before that was a previous moment? The mind of right now is not mind of the previous moment.
Yes.
So what they're saying is the nature of phenomena due to causes and conditions and dependent arising, these things that we are talking about as aggregates are empty of inherent nature. Mind does not come up by itself.
Yes.
The body does not come up by itself.
Mm-hmm.
The awareness does not come by itself. It is dependent on many causes and conditions. That's all it's saying.
Yes.
Cool?
Yes.
Okay. So,
May I ask one quick question because it ties in with that? I'm sorry. So subtle level of consciousness has always existed, will always exist. No?
Okay. No, when you go into dependent arising, next class, there is a very, very poignant point that it is not like you continue. You as a person that you think you are continues. It's the causes and conditions that every cause has an effect, and even your passing of your body, it has a seed of that activity of cause and effect that continues.
But that exists, though.
Okay.
That exists.
Well,
is that correct?
That, yeah. And it's everything in the... So when you say that emptiness itself is the truth, right? Emptiness is what? It is itself is the causes and conditions and dependent arising. So this cycle is also dependent arising. So therefore, emptiness is the truth. It exists. The emptiness is... The phenomena is the emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you are part of that. So to use word, does it exist or not, doesn't go with the thinking I have.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you just think, this is a phenomena. Things come into play through dependent arising, including you, your mind, your consciousness, everything. At some point, your consciousness and everything is what you think of is as a label, consciousness, all that goes away. But there is part of that continuum of causes and conditions and dependent arising that continues. So you can call it a subtle energy. Something you have to label it somewhere, yeah, to understand it. So we'll talk about that very nicely explaining dependent arising. And when you go through that logic, it's like almost like, oh, I think I got it, and then it kind of still questions, you question it. But it's not an easy subject. Then that's a great question, and she has a great question too. Okay? So again, here it's saying that when we are told the form is empty, people think nothing exists. But it's saying to here, he has to eliminate the error of nihilism. It is saying the second statement says, emptiness is form. In other words, emptiness appears as a form, or the appearance of the form itself is emptiness. It's the word emptiness is what gets people. But when you think of emptiness, it's like an oxymoron to your mind that you think nothing. But emptiness is a phenomena of dependent arising. So things are going on, causes and conditions, multitudes of that. Just think of that in a conventional way. It just keeps going on, right? You are just part of that, you know? So it's saying, and that's why it says that things do come. That's why you see and you name it, right? So it's not saying nothing exists. That's just part of the phenomena. It just does not exist inherently. That's the key thing. If you don't take anything away, you need to know that things don't exist inherently. Everything is dependent. That doesn't mean things don't come. They just don't exist inherently. And keep that in mind. You've got to repeat that a couple of times. What is the difference between things don't exist the way they appear? Because they don't exist inherently. And things are dependent arising. So what is dependent arising? And what is inherently you don't exist? Like we said, the cup. We can call it the cup. I can call him with the name. I can call Jennifer. I can say Gary. Those are conventional contracts saying, hey, call me Hemant. Call you so-and-so. Call you so-and-so. These are all conventions. But when I really look at you, you are dependent arising. That's the nature of things. So to save time, it's 8:30. Are you okay for another few minutes?
So is the subtlest consciousness the emptiness?
No. It cannot. You see, we want to put something in a bucket.
Yes.
What is it that I can carry in my purse that I can go with it? Right? It's not like that. Just think of phenomena is non-dual. Everything is in that phenomena. Everything is dependent arising. Think of it that way for right now. And then when you look at objectively, individually, just know that you don't exist inherently, that you are due to causes and conditions and dependent arising, you come to me. And then my mind sees, and instead of seeing the emptiness of you, I see a body, my mind has trained for me to call you a name and then give you a description very quickly. And then we see that as real. Right? Correct. But you just keep in mind that we live in a conventional world, so we have to see things the way we are labeling, but we have knowledge inside back of your mind that things are not the way they appear, because everything is due to causes and conditions. So if this gentleman is mad at me, if I had the ignorance and not knowing the truth that his causes and conditions and situation of his mind is causing that anger, I would take it personal because my ego is now up. Think who you think you are, right? But if I know that he's probably under some condition that is appearing to his mind in his ignorance, making his situation, he may have a bad day, he spoke with somebody else, whatever it can be, but I am not so attracted or being impacted by his nature now. What it does is it cuts the ignorance of not knowing the truth. Once you know the truth, now think of a meditative equipoise where a person is completely inside out, completely non-dual. Very difficult for us to even comprehend that because we don't practice. We kind of get a glimpse of it. We start to understand the theoretical value of it, but you need to abide in it. So let me go through this very quickly so that we don't get too behind here. So this is to show that there is a way that form does exist. It is not simply non-existent. It is the emptiness that appears as a form. The appearance of the form is its conventional reality, and the form being empty of inherent existence is its ultimate nature. So things do appear. We call it a name, so we see it's existing. But when you look at ultimately, everything is dependent arising. Just Take at least just take those two sentences in your mind right now and think about that. Having said that, form is emptiness and emptiness is form, it goes further into saying that they are not two different things. There is not emptiness there that exists over there, as I was saying. So it's non-dual. Everything is that way. Okay? Okay. So I'm going to just go through it again. Maybe we'll continue this. I think this requires a little bit more, because that's quite a bit of, if you go through every one of them, what does it mean by non-ceasing, ceasing, stainless? And I'll just tell you shortly before I answer his question, is that when you are in the, so this is path of accumulation. Path of accumulation and preparing, you're learning emptiness. You're sitting here today. You're accumulating. You're preparing. You're going to meditate on it. That's called the accumulation and preparation. So you're already on the train. Then when you fully understand and start to eradicate all your obscurations that are in our way right now, you want to still baggage. We somehow want to package it because that's how we think. We want to package it in one way. We don't see the entire thing in a proper fashion. But the path of seeing, when you are in meditation, what happens? You're not thinking about your eyes, are you? Are you thinking about your ears? Are you thinking about anything? You are in complete concentration of direct perception. That's why they say no tongue, no sound, and so forth. Okay? All right. This is a tough subject for a lot of people. All right? We will talk about that. We will talk about that. So to answer Jack's question, can I repeat that again? Okay. So I'll read it exactly here. So when we are told that the form is empty of true existence or lacks inherent existence, there's a possibility of falling into wrong view. Okay. So what we are saying is, conventionally things exist. However, they do not exist inherently. Okay. So when you take a look at these aggregates, we look at it, our mind projects a name conventionally agreed upon. We're going to call so-and-so Jack, we're going to call that a chair, we're going to call that table. This is all in the mind, right? But then we create a language. That's how we identify some things. But when you really look at something, you'll find out it's a dependent arising. It does not exist on its own. That's a simple concept. That's not difficult to understand, at least. Right? So when you go through this, when you go through Heart Sutra, each of those paths are assigned to each. And as you get into the higher stages of path of seeing and path of meditation, there is only one pointed concentration on emptiness. And when you're doing that and you see the reality, are you going to think about your sound and hear and no? So that's why they say no tongue, no sound. Okay? And in the end, it's confirmed by Buddha. They rejoice when Buddha says, that is the way it is. It's an approval. Okay, so the five aggregates we understand, form, feelings, discrimination, mental activities or formations, and consciousness, does not exist on their own. These are just labels. Then we go into other things, right? No eye consciousness, no sound consciousness. When you are in perfect meditation, even temporary, if you are not even in that level and you're meditating, you may get a vision for a second, but if you're truly, truly one point concentration, nothing will appear to you. You are in a bliss. Therefore, they don't exist. It only exists when you label something and look at it and say, oh, I'm going to call that an eye. That's what it's saying. All you have to walk away from here is saying, look at the things. We see things certain way. But when you really go at the deeper level, they don't exist the way they appear. They are dependent arising. Everything is dependent arising. And it's important to know that when you understand the entire phenomena, this room, this picture, you, me, everything is that way, now you develop a mindset. And when you can directly perceive that, my goodness, you know how things exist. And you don't need this ignorance, birth, death cycle, pain, all that. It becomes very clear you're in that state. And remember, Buddhas come from bodhisattvas. So in the end of the path, it says, no more learning. When you get enlightened, you're all knowing. All this comes from mental formations that we create. So there's a lot of arguments. There are a lot of schools that a lot of people touch it this way and that way, and it will go into a lot of detail about does the effect come first when the cause happens and all this kind of. In the end, you will find out moment to moment. Things were different here. Things are different here. They're always changing. And there are many factors, causes and conditions working on it for its next whatever it is.
So everything is like in flux.
Depending on the causes that created that effect. So, right, if I go like this, the effect is a little oops. But if I don't create that, it doesn't happen. So when you're training your mind for virtuous action, you're causing for a condition to be virtuous. Therefore, next stage, it becomes, goes to that side. You understand? Correct. Okay, so I would suggest that you do some reading, and if you have certain very personal questions, let's sit down and talk about it, because even I can, maybe sometimes it's hard to express it the correct way. I may have a mental picture, but then when it comes to talking about it, maybe the right words may not, you may think of it differently. If you can just walk away today and just know that all they're saying is perfection of wisdom, Buddha supported the fact through this conversation that all your aggregates and all the causes, the results, and what it is all dependent arising, that they don't exist from their own side. If things existed from their own side, they would be static. You would not even see anything. You would not know the difference. Because of changes in that, forms come. And that's why they say emptiness is not other than form. Emptiness is that. But we use the word emptiness in the mundane language of void of something. Yeah. And that's why it confuses the mind. So I want you to pay attention to those words, okay? So I will do a little dedication, and then we'll call it a close for today, and then we'll continue. Okay, so let's dedicate your efforts to understand this subject and meditate on its meaning to your attainment of Buddhahood, so that you will be able to lead each and every living being to the same enlightened state. Next class is the last class. It's a practice class. We'll finish this. We'll go into a little bit of dependent arising, and we'll do if time permitting, a four-point analysis, and we can have some discussions and how to purify and so forth.
So it
says it starts at 6:30. It's a little longer class. So let me ask you this. Do you need to, if anybody has a problem coming at 6:30, or do you want it to be at 7 o'clock, just like we have normal class? 6:30 okay with you?
Sounds like we need to start at 4.
You want? We can continue.
Yeah.